I think, without giving a mission goal, I think that it implies the mission goal. It talks about the theory and the premise behind it. And there's a lot of room for change within it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I became a program director, the first thing I did was give all of the department heads a copy of it. And I don't know if any of them read it. But that was, I believe that that was what we should be working from.
Yeah.
Anyway, this
I printed one. I printed one out and left it at home.
Okay. This group of
those who were listening last year, by the way, I read it verbatim, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
This group of conservatives began to balkanize all of the radio stations. By the way, you're listening to WBAI in New York.
In case you didn't know.
In case you didn't know. And they began to systematically change over the years all of the radio stations. So you had KPFT, a station that was bombed twice by the Klan.
And brought back on the air by money raised by WBAI.
That's right. And then next thing you know, that they are playing the music of the Klan. They're playing just country and western music. And if you've ever been to Houston and heard it over the last couple of years, I think it's changing now. I mean, it was just gut bucket, old hootenanny, swing your partner and dozy do kind of music that you hear coming out of KPFT. WPFW has...
Which was fully funded by WBAI.
Right, we bought it.
It was the Washington Bureau of WBAI.
Mm-hmm.
And to build the station, we held marathons and raised all the money.
Well, BAI is the cash cow. I mean,
we raise
more money than any three of the other radio stations.
And an undue percentage of the money that we raised would go, by the way, to Pacifica and not find its way back. This was always a big, big deal.
Well, that's all changed, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So they began to change KPFK. I was talking about PFW. PFW became primarily a jazz station. Very little public affairs.
PFW started that way. They were, we the staff, we felt betrayed. And this is again the 77 era.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we brought we paid for the station. We built the station. We had ideas. We were going to send producers down. We were talking about, you know, getting metro shuttles and being able to go there and produce between the two stations. And we were almost immediately locked out because all they were going to do was news and jazz.
Well, they dropped the news pretty much.
Yeah.
And all they do is jazz. It's a good jazz station. But if you look at Lou Hill's theory of listener-sponsored radio, that doesn't fit in.
All news doesn't do it, and all jazz doesn't.
Right,
do it.
KPFK in Houston, L.A., they systematically eliminated just about all of their Chicano, Asian, and African American producers, and just began focusing on a white, upper middle class, middle class population, so they wound up having fewer listeners, but they were getting more money. When you look at KPFA, there was a move to go in and take over KPFA in Berkeley and to change that station. They fought it, and they were able to hold them back. Then finally, they came into WBAI. Now, what happened to WBAI is that we had here on staff some individuals who did not come into radio the way you came in, or the way I came in, or the way Samori came in, or the way Valerie came in, with a desire to produce radio. We had some individuals who came in with a desire to get before a microphone and massage their egos.
Now, here's a modest proposal in one sentence. And when I say modest proposal, I mean in the Swiftian sense that nobody should take this too seriously, but the idea behind it, nobody should be allowed on the air until they've worked for the station for a year off the air, damn it.
Wow. Not only
prove
that.
Prove your loyalty.
People who come here should as you did and I did and Dolores Costello and Samori Marksman and Dred Scott Keys, is that you learn before you get before the microphone.
I started working here in 67 when I was 13 years old. I started producing tapes when I was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I went with 2 years of stuff. Then I could really become an intern. And then I started getting to be on the air.
Right.
And that was a valuable time.
Oh, no question about it. What happens is we don't talk too much about it now because the technology has changed. And so we, you know, there's all this digital editing where you do it on a computer now. But most of us sat in front of these Scullies, which is the tape recorders that we use, for hours learning how to edit tape, to seamlessly edit tape. And what you do when you do that, it is really art.
It is.
It becomes an art.
And as much as the digital editing is a brilliant science, but I think you lose a little something.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. But, you know, you learn the art of radio. You learn how some of the most beautiful things that someone who became the station manager here, I was telling them at one time that, you know, they really needed, this was before they became station manager, that they needed to sit down in front of the tape recorder and try and produce something. Something with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that they would learn more about radio if they did that. And they told me, in their very lofty way of speaking, that no one, that the reason why we sound like feces is because these machines don't work. That you cannot really produce anything of substance or value of artistic nature on these machines. Now, some of the most beautiful pieces of radio art ever produced in this country came off some of these Scullies right here at WBAI.
That is true. And, in fact, some of the majority of our award-winning programs, those Major Armstrongs, which were the biggest award in their era, were done on were stereo programs produced on mono Scullies. One track on one machine, one track on the other, both mastered onto this one stereo Scully that we had.
Yeah. And see,
you make do.
And that's what BAI was all. BAI has produced some of the best engineers in radio. Some of the best engineers because we learned how to make it happen.
And producers. The people who had to work under those conditions and who learned that stuff at WBAI comprise a who's who list in media today, for better and worse. We can mention former arts director John Lithgow. We can, you know, with his Tony's, Academy Awards, and TV series. We can mention the writer of the CBS Evening News for I don't know how many years now, Paul Fisher. And on and on.
Right. So the people that had come into WBAI who did not buy into the mission of WBAI, who were there just primarily because they felt a sense of self-importance. They felt that they were more important than WBAI. They were contacted by the officials in Pacifica, primarily the executive director, Bessie Wash. Alliances were made to put them where they thought their egos should be, which is in front of the microphone, in charge, and they used them to begin to dismantle WBAI.
But what was different now than, here's my, you know, like, you know, after the 77 thing, as I said, I moved back and I'd come in, do my show, and leave, as I will do this morning. And all through these years, I had heard of different directors of Pacifica, many of whom, as far as I'm concerned, were trying to do the same thing. We first heard about not just the nationalism of programming, but the NPRization and the corporatization of Pacifica with Sharon Maeda and that M-A-E-D-A. And she was followed by David Salnicker, who sort of moved a bit away from that position, at least from the corporatization and the NPR concept. I think he very well understands the difference between NPR and Pacifica, which I think that some of his predecessors and followers do not.
Mm-hmm.
But still the nationalization with a certain loss of community radio involved there. For me, much of what I was hearing about the corporatization and all that was what I have been hearing for 25 years. And so when I would hear people say that Pacifica is becoming corporate, it's like, okay, demonstrate this. Show me how. And, well, here's a person on the board who's a vice president of Citibank. I raise my hand. Oh, it's an assistant vice president of Citibank.
Yeah, but there's a difference there.
I have to know who this person is was my only point.
Well, exactly. Now, because what we had on the national board until the change came is people who you might have been a vice president of Citibank, but you knew how to sit down in front of a tape recorder and produce a program. These people have no real association with radio. They view radio in the same way that they viewed Citibank, that it should be a profit-making organization.
Whereas I worked at Citibank in order to be able to afford to work here.
Exactly. And see, one of the problems that we face, too...
I should mention, by the way, before rumors go rampant... By the way, that I was a network manager, and you can't be a network manager at Citibank without having a title.
Mm-hmm. That when you talk about NPRization, one of the things that people were struggling with when I came here in 1980 was CPB. What does it mean to take CPB money?
Oh, yeah.
And CPB has had its influence on the national board. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There was a time, 75 or so, Larry mm-hmm. Josephson was station manager, and CPB monies were starting to come in. And at that time, we were 100% listener-sponsored,
mm-hmm.
no grants. And when CPB money was coming in, there were huge staff meetings and fights over. I remember specifically one person who was on the local board before it was dissembled, saying, "The wolf is at the door. Don't let them in."
Mm-hmm.
And I still believe that we would be better off had we not.
Well,
find alternate sources of funding.
Well, we would be. Well, that's true. As long as we were cognizant that this CPB money, that we would have it with no strings attached. I mean, that it was money that was laid out for radio stations as we are, and that there had to be no strings attached. But if CPB,
initially it was for capital. Only.
Right, but if CPB is going to dictate or impose itself on the kinds of station that we become, then we should reject the money.
But the thing is that they do so in a very subtle way. They do it by saying, grants in general, do it by saying, we're offering money for this one thing. And so a producer who would otherwise go out and view the whole wide world is now directed toward that one thing.
Sure.
It's I don't quite have the word for it. It's not censorship, but it's a pulling in a direction.
Well, the same thing happens in government when government makes money available to do studies, and so that becomes what the folks, the scientists, wind up putting in their applications for their requests. The RFPs, request for proposals. They
trivia question, by the way.
What's that?
Challenge you. Who founded CPB? Love this one.
Who founded CPB? Not sure.
Spiro T. Agnew.
Spiro.
Spiro in order...
The nattering nabob of negativism.
Exactly. So, in order to suppress the gaggle, of, as Bob Fass would put it.
By the way, this is a fundraising period, isn't it?
Funny you should mention that.
Yeah. By the way, folks, if you're interested in supporting this radio station, what you can do is to call us at area code 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950.
Yeah, we should put that number up because, you know, when I started the show, I didn't know what the pitching number was.
Okay, 212-209-2950.
And
this is Hour of the Wolf. I'm up at this time in the morning. You should just pay for that to get me up on a Saturday morning to come out and to be a part of Jim Freund's program.
And this is the first time I have seen you since all this went down.
I heard you, though, during this period. You were doing
I was on the air for like
for
3 days for some
yeah.
reason. Should I tell that story?
Well, yeah, because I think...
I've never told this story on the air.
You received the ire of a lot of people. A lot of people were very upset with you.
Yeah, yeah. The so-called coup, as it went down, was on a Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a phone call at home saying, well, let's see if you're on the air at 5 a.m. And, you know, pangs of 77 going through my head. I usually show up for my show, you know, 4:30. I was there at 1. And as I come in, wait, you know, trying to figure out how I'm going to talk my way, bust my way into this situation and all that, I see somebody now recently pronounced as the new station manager, Utrecht lead leaving the building, and I said I thought that there are access issues, and she said if you are supposed to be on the air, be on the air, and we spoke for about a minute, and I went up and discovered that the so-called lockout was for anybody not scheduled on the air. And the lockout was a weekend-long lockout. And if you were supposed to be on the air, you got in. So immediately, I felt that things were different than they were in 77. I have a very skeptical view of both sides in all this. Both sides. Because I have a very...
Who are the sides?
That is the important question. And as I said earlier, at one point I perceive the sides as the politicians versus the artists. Or it's always us versus them. But my perception was is that what was going on in 77 was revolution. And what was going on now... was a civil war. And I noted Juan Gonzalez used those same words. And I am a politically unastute person. He's politically astute. So I'm not sure, maybe it's for different reasons, but I thought I had hit something on the mark there. And what I was perceiving were more power plays within facets of the organization rather than just the imposition. The rhetoric that I was reading in the newspaper from Pacifica did not entirely displease me, the idea of broadening the audience. Not taking away any of the guts, but going back to a larger listenership, which we certainly had at one time, and I don't think it was only because of the era. I think it was also because of the radio dramas and music programs and a less politically defined programming agenda. This is all opinion here.
Yeah, because
that's perception
it,
I'm talking about.
I think
about.
It was because of the war in Vietnam.
Maybe so. Yeah. I'm not talking truth here. I'm talking my perception.
Okay.
Which is the only thing that to me was relevant.
That's a shame.
Well, maybe it is.
Yeah.
I'll concede that. I have a very jaded and cynical view of politics, all of it.
Well, I don't know how you could say you have a.
This is not a. This is not a boast.
All of it.
I don't even.
Probably comes from a lack of understanding of it.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Not maybe so. Probably so.
Yeah.
Probably so. I think I understand political forces on huge, large scales, not on how they work and what they are, and I am very naive on many of them. In 77, I saw no problems until they were upon me and the weight had descended. I am not going to say I am one of the first people, like Bob Faz, who saw what was going on immediately and charged into it. I was one of the last. You know, and then I'm proud to say that I did what I thought was appropriate at that time. But for me at that time, everything was blatant and obvious. What was going on here now is that I was told that you were not going to be doing Wake Up Call, the 6 to 9 a.m. program. And would I please take Therese called me at home. And would I please take the show over? This is now to be my show 4 days a week. I said, thanks. No thanks. I have a new job starting the following week, the beginning of January. And why would you want me? And Utrecht said, to talk about the 77 things and how... And your perception, which was my perception then, that was the big crisis, that this is almost minor, which at that time it felt like to me, in comparison. And to talk about your old war stories was the actual word that she used. And so forth. And I thought, gee, I remember in 77 how the one person who seemed to make the most sense, who I really admired, was Steve Post, who did not take either side. But yelled at everybody saying, you're destroying the station. And I think in retrospect, see, yeah, good point. And I thought maybe, foolishly, I thought maybe I can do that. Maybe I can be a voice of neutrality and reason and try to talk about and present, like we are this morning,
but see,
the issues of BAI politics.
But see, that's when your political naivete got in the way. What happened is, you know, like Howard Zinn has this book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. You could not be neutral. Steve Post was not neutral at that time, although his rhetoric was one of neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I've gone out to speak at a variety of different places all over the country and the issue of neutrality would come up, I would always, Martin Luther King used to always quote from Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those people who in time of great crisis maintain their neutrality. What one has to do in those times is learn the issues and then take a side. There were some obvious wrongs that were done. People were fired. There was an attempt to destroy their lives, to assassinate their character almost on a daily basis here at WBAI. That this kind of behavior was sanctioned by the administration. In fact, they nurtured that kind of behavior, which at some points got close to being very physical, that women were attacked in a very brutal way on these microphones daily, and the people who were doing the attacking were being rewarded. So,
well, this is what ended up happening over time. I certainly perceived that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is right in the very beginning that I'm talking about, where I came on.
It seems that one should have talked to some of the people at that time, because if in order to do that, when you made a decision to do that, you would, at that point, you had taken a side.
You see, what I was hoping to do was to be a conduit. And what...
A conduit.
Yeah, in other words, a method by which all these sides could be heard, could be brought to the air with questions. The only journalism, outside of the writing that I do, the only political stuff that I've done in all my years at the station was, believe it or not, I was anchor for the War Report, the Gulf War. And it was a nightly show that produced by Andrew Phillips, and I was the host and leader of that show. Perhaps the last qualified person on these grounds. And I think I did a darn good job because of my naivete, and there was an article in the New York Times praising me for my insight. My insight composed of I knew nothing. And so what I did was I asked all of these naive questions, and I learned on the air what the issues of the war were, what, you know, who had claim to this land centuries back, and who are the players, who are the issues. And by asking such dumb questions, I was cited as having great insight. And I never hid the fact that I was asking these questions out of naivete and coming out of a place saying, gee, I don't know what's right here. And this is what I was hoping to be able to do, was to come into the situation with that same kind of naivete and get to the bottom of things. What I did not count on was that when Andrew Phillips put me into the position of doing the war report, he was not there. He was not putting me on the air so that I could be manipulated by any side. When I foolishly accepted the job of doing what I called the morning show, I would not call it wake-up call, because I could not do wake-up call. Wake-up call has a very distinct definition of what it was, of what it does. And that is a mission goal that I could never hope to reach. I was hoping to do three programs, three-hour programs with an hour of music and then 2 hours of let me investigate on the air and find out what was going on. This was not to be. When I came in, the usual co-hosts and participants of Wake Up Call were there to do the show, something I had not expected. It was also not my job to say, you're not going to be on the air. I'd let them on. What else could I possibly do? This is my thinking. And, of course, immediately, by doing that, I set myself against them. Probably a little bit in my mind. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because now, instead of being neutral, I'm now in an adversarial kind of circumstance because I'm trying to question people. So, initially, the conversations I'm having are, but, and I'm dealing with very good, concise speakers that know what they're doing. And there was a certain amount of manipulation happening among them that I will keep off the air and tell you off the air that I was not pleased by. Which is nothing compared to the manipulation that in the second hour of the first show, the second speaking hour of the first show, then Utrice, who was supposed to have been there to begin with and never showed up until late, came in as the guest. And, of course, what I had wanted was everybody in the same room. And instead, it just turns out to be a conversation between she and I. And she would ask these very... I don't want to say manipulative or leading questions, but questions in such a manner for which there's only one answer. And I, those people who know Hour of the Wolf, know that I am not as much an interviewer as I am a host. My job is to provide a platform for artists and thinkers and people to so that the listeners out there can see them at their best and make their decisions about those artists. My editorial control is choosing who those people are to begin with. That's how I think of Hour of the Wolf in its artistic form. And so what I became was a person who I was way out of my depth.
I think I told you that.
Yes, but you and I didn't get a chance to speak. In fact, I wanted to call you at that time. And one associate, both of yours and mine, you probably don't realize I know. Suffice it to say, this is my bookkeeper, who had an association with Wake Up Call, said it would probably not be a good idea to call you, that you would be unhappy, and I'm sorry I didn't call you.
Oh, no.
I was so paranoid at that point.
Well, I felt that I understood what was happening. As a matter of fact, Mario Murillo was doing a program on Friday, and I thought that he just had... We're going to have to raise some money here.
Yeah.
Mario Murillo was doing a program, and I called into the program because there was a whole lot of talk about, you know, we're going to see if we can straighten this out and bring Bernard back, and he and Utrecht can work together. And I knew that that was not the issue at all. That what had happened at WBAI is that its autonomy had been taken away by the imposition of planting Utrecht's lead or anybody else in the position of station manager. And that in order for our autonomy to be returned, that whoever was placed in that position, at this time it was Utrecht's lead, had to be removed. And that Pacifica had to put everything back the way it was, and that we would make our own decisions about where we go from here.
What is very interesting is that what you just said is spun differently than what I got third hand is of what you were saying at that time. What you say now makes perfect sense and resonates fine.
And I told people then, I said, many people may not understand it, but in time you'll understand that that's this issue.
What I got that you were saying at that time, which really disappointed me, was that Bernard White would not return to the station until this and that was removed and changed. That sounded like an ultimatum, which is not what you just presented.
Well, you know, I mean, there was a whole cottage industry, as I call it, of pretense and falsehoods that was created here.
Well, and show, by the way, how this went both ways. When I announced on the air that I would not be doing the morning show for more than 3 days because I was starting a new job, a rumor started that I was to be the next program director of WBAI.
Well, yeah, those kind of things.
Did you hear that one?
No, I didn't hear that one.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that.
But I understood what was going on, and I wasn't alone in that. There were many of us who did understand. I mean, Juan Gonzalez understood, Amy understood, Dan Coughlin understood, and Valerie understood, Sharan Harper understood. And what we had to do was to figure out a way to get that message to everybody else about what was going on, because it was purposely made confusing to people about what was going on. Because, you know, when things are confused, those people, you can maintain power while, you know, to do all the confusion. So we had to figure out a way of getting this information to the people. Juan Gonzalez, who had been a veteran of a corporate campaign, we sat down several times before he announced that he was leaving Democracy Now. We came together, we discussed how we were going to do this, and that then we went and we pulled it off. Juan, on January 31st, decided that he would resign at that time, and we would launch the campaign, that he would announce prior to his resignation some websites and some telephone numbers, so that if he got cut off, that people would have that information. And then when he made the announcement, we started. We had a campaign headquarters that was set up on 13 Gay Street and Bill Kunstler's old office, and that was our war room, and we systematically went after who the real enemies were. We didn't attack Utrecht's lead. We didn't attack anybody at the station. We went to where the source of the problem was.
I noticed that. I certainly noticed the everything was going on, and for me it was very surreal. mm-hmm. because I'm here in my little shell
right.
at this time.
So we identified where the problems were, and we systematically came up with programs and actions and activities to eliminate those problems. Then we came back to deal with WBAI. And our goal was not to just transform WBAI, but to transform the network back to its mission. So when BAI, on January the 12th, when WBAI, the decision was made to restore everyone back to WBAI, which is what I said from the very beginning had to happen, changes also were taking place at KPFT, PFW.
This was a national referendum, not a local
right.
one, as it happened with KPFA.
And that's what we wanted, that the mission and the direction of Pacifica had been altered and that it had to all be reversed and we have to work back toward the mission. And we were successful. We went, and the only reason why we were successful is because although some of the people here at the staff were unclear, our listeners were very clear. They were very clear that you don't come in the middle of the night and change locks and fire people and never give a reason why they were fired. You know, every day there was somebody coming to the air saying, you're going to find out.
See, I almost understood the business about changing locks given their position. The method of firing people, the never announcing it, was terrible. And in the later days, the things that gave me the worst chill was about 3 months ago going into the operations office and seeing a list of what programs had to be air-checked. The list itself told the story.
Yeah.
That to me, I think, was the greatest, personally, from the ostrich point of view, the greatest chill I got.
Since you're politically naive, you probably haven't looked at revolutions and how they take place. And what happens inside of a revolution.
It's so funny you should say that. Very quick story. Science fiction writer Constance Ash, I was meeting with her. Her husband is a producer of Cubano salsa and music, and they're very familiar with these cultures, live a great deal in Havana and New York. As this stuff was going down, the Wednesday of the night that I was hosting the morning show, I was telling her what was going on and all this. And she said, it's a revolution. This is what goes on in Cuba. This is what goes on.
Well, not so much in Cuba.
Right? Maybe not. I might be misquoting her. Yeah. But it sounded like she had it down perfectly.
She might have said Chile or... you know, this was a classic fascist dictatorship. This was a fascist takeover with all of the classic things that get placed in... put into place. You had the department here that became the police headquarters. That's where you saw that list of programs that had to be identified. People were just hired there with no real job functions just because they were the muscle. You know, you have to have the muscle. You have to intimidate the people so that they won't think about fighting you back. You have to begin to systematically eliminate all opposition. You have to defame the character of the people that you're eliminating. Even though one day they were good friends and, you know, you could laugh and joke with them, the next day they were enemies of the state.
And this is, by the way, why I perceived it as a civil war, because the friends were... That's not what happened in 77.
Well,
77, the lines were clear. Now, it was friends versus friends.
And,
it seemed to me.
Right. And, you know, so we... those were the things that we had to deal with. And, you know, the listeners, as I said, many of them were very clear. They formed listener groups. They, all over the country, friends of the various radio stations would come together and develop on their own strategies about how they could get their radio stations back. These groups were not micromanaged. They decided, for instance, up in Rockland County, that where they had offices of Epstein, Becker, and Green, or any of the other offices of folks who were working on the national board, they organized demonstrations, they passed out leaflets, they had fundraisers, they came together to discuss what was going on. We visited up there, we talked to them, we have organized a national network of community organizations to take back Pacifica. And it worked. It was a beautiful thing. When this story finally gets told, it is a magnificent story of how communities came together to retrieve something that had been stolen from them.
209-2950.
We're going to concentrate on that a lot in a few minutes. But the people here inside of WBAI, most of the staff inside was so intimidated that they never got an opportunity or took the time to really figure out what was going on and that what they were a part of. That this was a national struggle that that came from the bottom up. That people here were being used by someone who was very clever, someone who is very articulate. And a lot of times what happens with us is that we focus on how people are saying what they have to say instead of what it is they're saying. And we get taken off as a result of that. But our listeners stayed the course. 1 year later, when the telephones would open, people would say, what you did was terrible. And the fight and the band need to come back. They would not let it die. It wasn't me. It wasn't Juan. It wasn't Amy. It wasn't Dan. It was the listeners who kept this whole thing alive because they knew that something had been taken from them.
Yeah. I also heard a lot of dissent, you know, a lot of confusion among a lot of listeners as well.
Well, I think that there was some confusion. That there's a confusion right here on the staff.
I'm certainly confused.
That the most of the listeners were clear. They didn't have all the details, but they were clear. By the way, we're going to have to really concentrate on getting some money in here.
Okay.
Your show ends at 7 o'clock?
That's correct.
Okay.
And
so
I get off at 6:50, 6:30.
We need to have some people calling right now. We've only got 9 minutes left, folks. I want to thank Jim for the opportunity to come in.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this because this is essential. This is the February 11th program, which will continue, needs to focus on these issues.
Okay.
Every year.
212-209-2950. There's nobody calling right now. I'm not used to this. I'm used to... Okay, thank you. Won't you let them hear the phones ring?
Oh, I don't know how to
right
pot
here.
That up.
Just
which pot is it?
Right there, yeah.
Okay,
we have one caller on the line right now. You can join that caller and call into Tally and find out just what it is you have to do to become a part of this radio station. Thank you for those calls. Thank you. 212-209-2950. There are two people on the line right now. There are three people on the line right now. Let's fill this board up. If you heard anything that you thought was important this morning, then that's all the more reason to become a part of this radio station. Thank you.
I mean,
seven people on the line right now. Please become a part of this radio station. Support free speech. Jim doesn't know that he can raise a lot of money right now before leaving here. Thank you for those people that are calling. Hopefully there are enough people in Tally to take those phone calls. We're already on the second bank. 212-209-2950. There are people running to Tally now to take some of those calls. Please, just continue to call. We need your support. It's very important that you support this radio station and support the fact that we were able to sit down and hopefully you were able to get something out of the conversation this morning.
Yeah, exactly, because certainly from my point of view, and you know, finally, by the way, I was able to, during this program, I was finally able to do what I hoped to do on the morning show then, which is come from a place of naivete and start learning. And this, I think, can be a valuable thing for listeners. The important thing to know here is, as you're all listening, what you're hearing is that there is a commodity, there is a treasure at risk here. And that treasure is the premise of listener sponsorship. That treasure is the broadcast capabilities of a listener sponsored radio stations staying true to the Pacifica ideals as laid out by Lou Hill. And what you are hearing are the pains of the vigilance of keeping that alive. It has put this organization deeply deeply into debt. And it is therefore essential that...
Oh, we didn't talk about that.
The healing has to begin, and unfortunately, it's up to you to supply some of the Band-Aids. 212-209-2950.
And please be patient. We have a lot of people who are calling in. We only have a few folks in the back, but please don't let this moment pass. If you feel that you should subscribe at this point, if there's anybody in the station who's not doing anything right now, please, can you go back to the tally room and help the folks out in tally? They're being deluged with a lot of calls right now. 212-209-2950. Please continue the call. Someone will get to you. Please be patient. It's early in the morning.
And if we can't get to you right now, call during Simon's show. Normally, we get very selfish when we're pitching. And we say, you've got to support me so that the program director knows that I'm doing a great job. In this case, what's important is that the money come in.
Just continue to call. Call during now.
Just keep calling.
Call during Simon's program, please. 212-209-2950.
This is an excellent time of year, by the way, to give gift subscriptions. This is an excellent time of year to not only subscribe to for yourself, but to let other people know that WBAI is in a healing process, is in a process of coming back on the air. And the best way to do that is by, after you take a subscription for yourself, give a subscription to a friend, or better yet, to an enemy. You take out another subscription, you put your name on as the donor, but then you put somebody else's name on as the beneficiary of that subscription and expose them to WBAI and help us build the community itself. And by doing that, of course, you're giving us more financial aid.
Thanks 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Let's see if we can load it up again. We had about 15 people on the line before. Let's get these people a workout back in tally. 212-209-2950. We do want to thank those of you who have been calling. It's a very good showing this morning. Seems that people are up this early in the morning.
Oh, yes. This is prime time. 6 a.m. apparently on a commercial station on a Saturday is prime time.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but when I was moved into this slot, I used to be on weekdays, of course.
Yeah.
I used to... when I was moved into the slot, I came kicking and screaming and discovered that there's a wonderful audience here now. And on commercial stations, it's considered prime time. So all of you prime listeners out there now, please, now more than ever, 212-209-2950.
I'll have to go do something with this coffee.
Okay, well, you'll be back in a moment. In the meantime, again, bear in mind that everything that you're hearing, what you are hearing, are not for all the different ideologies, for all the different perceptions, for all the different things that are going on, I think that we can agree that the voices that you're hearing in this room and some not in this room all agree on the point that it is this forum of listener sponsorship that is to be treasured, that must be kept alive. And this is the morning on which to do it, folks. You will hear me pitch at different times of the year and all that, and so you'll hear it in different forms. Sometimes entire mini marathons will go by and they say, oh, there's no need for Hour of the Wolf to pitch. This is the morning in which I really hope you do. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. This is an extremely important program for me because, as I said, for me, it provides a learning process about much of what I was, we have all been involved in, how, to whatever witting or unwitting extent we may have been. And it's very interesting to hear the different perceptions of the thing. There is so much more to discuss. I mean, questions that I would like to know are, where we hope to be in 5 years and things like this. But right now, the thing to do is to make sure that there will be another 5 years for us. Pacifica is us. We is Pacifica. And at this point, we have inherited the debt of one of the many previous Pacificas. And we all need to work together. The five stations need to work together. Hopefully the affiliates will work together. But the crux of the whole thing is the premise of listener sponsorship. Right now there are three of you calling in to pledge. Please let us make that more. 212-209-2950. We have 5 minutes left. I still hope to make some announcements about what's going to be coming up in future weeks and some closing words from Bernard. So please make that call now. 212-209-2950. There are four calls coming in. Please let's get a fifth and then a sixth. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. As I said, we have only begun to scratch the surface on many of these issues, many of these questions. Bob Fass called while we were off the air. Maybe I have to do another show that Bob can talk on, because especially about 77, he and I have very different perceptions. And there are a great many people with a great deal to say, and this is obviously something that needs to be ongoing. And on this program, Hour of the Wolf, I tend to control the talk to the topic of the morning. But this is the topic of the morning, and the need of the morning is the need of the survival of the radio station. Right now, four people are calling. One call dropped off. Others have come in. Their lines are free.
Thank you. 212-209-2950. If you were calling a few moments ago and you weren't picked up, now's a good time to call back. Thank you.
212-209-2950. A regular subscription to WBAI is $50. You can get a what we always called a student, retired, unemployed, or just can't
fixed
afford
income
a subscription
for
$25. But we will also take any and all donations of, is it $10 or more?
$10
or more. We love plastic, by the way. We're corporatized to that extent. The plastic brings us the money.
Not all bad.
Immediately. No, it's not all bad. But credit cards are great for us. It allows you to pay off in a period of time that you see fit, and it allows us to get the money immediately. And boy, do we need that immediately.
We have about 3 minutes left, folks.
212-209-2950. Give a gift subscription. Give a subscription to a friend or an enemy. That is a great thing. I know many of you have come to the call already, and many of you have donated during different programs.
And many of you have enemies.
And many of you haven't. So in which case, you've got to catch up to the others and take out two subscriptions at the same time just in order to be able to catch up. 212-209-2950. Area code 212-209-2950.
Okay, we're down to two callers.
Only two
callers.
Let's
see if we can get those of you who called earlier.
That means it's your turn.
Didn't get in? That's right.
You can,
thank you. Thank you for that call. Thank you for those calls. 212-209-2950.
Our tally is at 830. I will be very disappointed if we don't reach $1,200, $1,300, $1,400, or $1,500 in the next couple of minutes. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. No calls at this moment. There's one. Thank you.
Can we get two?
Think
Let's
after this program,
two.
No calls. Come on. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. No calls coming in again. All those people who were calling before and didn't get picked up on, this is your turn. This is your time to give
Thank you for that
us
call.
A call.
Thank you.
One call coming in, that means nine more of you can get through in due time.
See, when you say nine more, you're dating yourself.
When the bingo used to be 10.
Right.
Exactly. But I figure, hey, 10 people call up, we'll take those 10 at a time, you know?
Okay.
It's a virtual bingo.
Well, thank you very much for those of you who have been calling in.
Nine.
I'm sure we can get to that $1,000 mark. 212-209-2950. Why don't you call us right now? You can help us to break that $1,000 barrier.
Yeah, I mean, just one pledge of $50 will break
that.
That's
all we need.
But we also want to go beyond that. There's no reason why in the 1 minute of pitching
lag,
there's no reason why we won't break that.
I believe you. I believe
the
you.
Light has come on. 212-209-2950.
Okay.
There's a stage
this
setting
be a major
for Simon's show. Have you ever seen this before? It's a great thing. 212-209-2950.
Thank you for that call. Thank you. Ah, there we go.
Okay. Oh, okay. There's $1,005. So now, can we do 2,000? Probably not. But we can do another $100.
That might be a... Yeah, I think so.
We can do another $100.
We got 1 minute. Here. No, we got 30 seconds. 212-209-2950 is the number that you call, please. Call right now. Support WBAI. Support this program. Support the whole conversation that was held. The
support
fact
listener
be,
sponsorship, for
right.
God's sake. What people have to realize is that all of that, what we're talking about this morning, are the pains of the vigilance of keeping this premise of listener sponsorship alive. We are very different from National Public Radio. NPR is a great thing. So are we. And one without the other would not be a good thing. But if you had to choose one, choose listener support. We are, what are we at this point, 85% listener supported?
Just about
85% yeah. Listener supported. I, too, was once on the local board. I know these numbers. And I would love us to become 100% listener supported. 212-209-2950. Simon is shadowboxing, getting ready to do his pitching on the air.
He's shadowboxing and losing.
Yeah, which is in and of itself is a political statement. Everything's political as I naively stumble my way. Thank you, Bernard.
Thank you.
This was illuminating. It was way too short, unfortunately. I'm sure for some listeners it was way too long. but it's essential. It's essential that we learn. At some point, I would love to continue the conversation, maybe even on tape, to see how to trace the 77 through the present.
Mm-hmm.
Because do you agree that there's connectivity between what went on then and what has been occurring this last year?
There are pieces of connective tissue that happened between both of these two events. We need to really dissect it and find out exactly what was going on, because it's an important part of understanding WBAI and an important part of making sure that these kinds of things don't continue to happen. Although, there's an argument that could be made that it's inevitable for these kinds of things to happen given the nature of the institution that we're in. There's no blueprint.
To keep us revolutionary?
Well, there's no blueprint for it. And at some point, it's going to undergo changes.
One of our best programmers ever, Julius Lester, when he left the station, quoted Thomas Jefferson saying, "When a revolutionary organization becomes an institution, it is time to have another revolution in that organization." And I wonder if that has, if this is part of the growing of that and the maintaining that cycle that Julius was talking about.
Well, that's another program.
That's another program and fascinating stuff. Bernard, thank you again for giving up at least some hours off, if not days off. Should we do this?
Well, it's up to Simon.
We won't run into his time. I'm just not going to play a theme. Okay. But there are a lot of people who have called and pledged here to be thanked. I don't think the list is large enough that we're not going to be able to go through all the names. But you know who you are, and thank you.
David starts late, and everyone starts late. So.
If your name is not in front of me now, it's not too late to put it in front of Simon.
I take no responsibility for it.
Yeah, right. 212-209-2950. Next week on this program, Rudy Rucker. In the next few weeks, Walter Mosley, who'll be here live, actually. David Brin, Deborah Raji. We've got some wonderful guests and some neat fiction coming up, but remember how fiction reflects reality. Oh, is this morning?
That's yours.
Okay. So, thank you all for listening. No Steel Eye Span this morning. And next week, a sort of normaler program, as it were.
Return to normalcy.
Return to normalcy as it exists. Are we pitching next week here? Am I pitching on this show next week?
Yeah.
Okay, I am pitching on the show next
week.
Say what?
Nobody else wants to get up this hour.
Yeah, right. No, but it's a pitching. You know, other program directors didn't want pitching in this hour.
Oh, okay.
I'm okay. I'm pitching next week. We'll see what will be on. We'll try to get you to call then. Stay tuned for Simon Locally. I'm not going to do an outro thing. I'm just going to stand up, hand Max the pledges. Simon's got his lighting. He's got his pillow. He's got his stage manager. Or is it house manager?
Electrical engineer at the moment.
Ah, okay. Again, thank you all for listening.